It's on, okay. I'd like to call to order the Conference Committee on Senate File 3337. And we don't have this, or we just acquired the side-by-sides, so, and we haven't had a chance to proofread them yet. So what we have done is put together Senate File 3337 as it came off the House floor, and a few bills that are going to be included in it. So what we have available, and we will be working off, is Senate File 3337 as it came off the House floor, and we will be pulling in the other bills as and the Senate companions as we come to that section. Next time we meet, we should be able to have the side-by-sides available to you. There also is a handy little document that shows the various sections of the Conference Committee document, and that will help you to follow along also. And I'm going to start by turning it over to Mr. Fuller, who will walk us through those sections then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. I will be working in order of this document. As you can see on the left-hand side, it's referring to Section 1, which is of something that's called the Petrol Fund Bill. It's got Senate File 3061, Senate location, it passed the Senate, Senate author Skoy, then the House file, House author, and then a comparison. And I'll go through a chunk that's related, then I'll turn it over to Mr. Eloff to comment on the House position, and hopefully we can get through here quick. Is everybody on the House on the Energy Committee side, so you're familiar?
Yes.
Okay, so the first one is there's four sections, 1 to 3 on the left side there, and then Section 26, which is a repealer. It's later on. They relate to the Petrol Fund. They're fairly technical. Section 1 simply changes a reference to a board or an agency and clarifies who can bring legal action. Sections 2 and 4, which is a repealer, simply eliminate some language having to do with some reimbursement programs that the Petroleum Tank Release Compensation Board has done. And so that leaves Section 3, which is a new program. This did not go through our committee, but it's fairly plain. If there's PVC piping and it's causing a residential spill in a residence and it's fixed, there's a level of reimbursement that will be provided in that case for a period of time. And so I assume it's related to a very specific problem. There's a cap of $1.5 million total in the program and not more than $250 per location. So we did not hear testimony on that in our committee, but I assume it's a problem out there and this helps take care of it. Bob?
Yeah, I would just add that Section 3 was put into the bill in the House because I think it was they wanted to make sure that this was a one-time program that was addressing a specific need.
Members, we do have that column on the right that says same or similar, and if we had a side-by-side, I suppose we could actually move to adopt them, but I don't think we're going to do that, and it wouldn't take much work to go back and do it. So, okay, so we go to Section 4, 2628, Public Service Corporation Exception. That is in the Senate in a bill carried by Senator Dill, which you see is in Judiciary. And what it does is in our eminent domain laws, there's some special treatment for what's called public service corporations, which is the defined term, and it's a lot of things. It's all your utilities and cable and gas companies and some other things as well. And this takes out an exception from the eminent domain law, so it applies something to public service corporations that wasn't previously applied. It has to do with some assessment or appraisal and negotiation requirements, which this bill would now apply to eminent domain proceedings by a public service corporation. Bob?
Well said, John.
Okay. Then we have another block of material. Senator Dahl has two bills in here that match up. It looks like it goes Section 5 through Section 8. And what this proposal is essentially trying to align our regulation of electric utilities with some of the obligations that we have put on them and give them some incentive. It's called cost recovery. Historically, utilities have had to go to the PUC to get rates to recover their costs. And this allows for a different procedure with still some review, but they don't have to go in for a full-blown rate case. And that's reflected in most of these sections. Section 5, it says here Section 5, but it's Section 1 and 3758, which is in your packet. We have a cost recovery provision that's in current law that allows for recovery of certain transmission costs. And added to that is when utilities can incur costs for projects by other utilities when it's allocated by MISO, the Midwest Independent System Operator, and this allows those or makes eligible for cost recovery those category of costs. That's the language on line 15 to 18. Also, in addition, on line of the Senate file 3758, Senator Dahl, it adds a class of projects, those that are exempt from the certificate of need law, to other projects for which cost recovery is allowed. Section 6, which is Section 2 in the 3758, clarifies the commission authority to allow cost recovery, makes a technical change because the renewable energy standard used to be an objective, and this changes to obligation. I think it flips back again in the House. Not significant. On line 9 and 10, another class of projects that are eligible for cost recovery are these storage facilities, renewable energy generation facilities that can contribute to the reliability, efficiency, or cost effectiveness of the renewable facility. So that's a new class of facility. Section 3, which is Section 7 on this model document, is a technical change. Section 4 is a new provision, and it allows cost recovery with respect to renewable facilities if they were exempt from the certificate of need law under a new exemption provided for in Section 5. And Section 5 provides on page 4, line 30, sets the requirements of this section, which is a certificate of need, do not apply to a wind energy conversion system or a solar electric generation facility that is intended to be used to meet or exceed the RES. But there will still be a commission review. I think that's referred to as regulation light. So that's the rest of the first page of this schematic document. Bob?
Do you want me to continue or respond to what you're saying? I agree with what you said.
Well, this is number 9 on page 2 of the schematic comparison, section 9. The Senate proposal to have a carve-out, it's called a carve-out of the RES for solar, lost in committee. So I guess that's what it was, it lost in committee. Bob, what is the House provision?
It's a carve-out that starts by the end of year 2012, at least 0.8% of what's now in the RES has to be generated by solar energy, and 60% of that needs to be distributed solar energy at a customer's site. And we're talking here about projects with a total peak capacity of 100 kilowatts or less. And that applies to both residential property and small businesses.
Section 10, 11, and 12, and 13 related back to the early one, I neglected to say, is another solar bill. Just a little background. It's related to SIP. And SIP used to be a spending requirement. And that's what you had to do. You had to spend a certain level of money to satisfy your SIP obligation. And last year that was changed. But before it was changed, there was a law passed that allowed some generation, not conservation, to be used to meet SIP in a separate statute. 5% of your spending could be used because you had a spending requirement. Okay, so then last year we went to, I think this background will help you. Last year we kept the spending requirement, but we went to an energy conservation percentage requirement as well. So the law that let 5% of your spending go to generation, of course, you may not get any conservation out of that, so there's kind of a misfit there. So what this bill does, Section 10, which is Section 1 of 3698, describes qualifying solar energy projects for the purpose of SIP. And it says that the cost effectiveness of these projects can be judged on a differential basis in other SIP because the fact of the matter would be they're not cost effective and they would not pass that test better than other projects. They would come after them. So you would have less likelihood, far less likelihood of having a solar project qualify at the current time. Okay. And it sets a bunch of ground rules for how these projects are going to be treated under SIP. They can meet not the first 1%. They can be applied to the 1.5% goal. And there's other provisions in there clarifying how these solar projects will fit within the SIP regime. Section 2 simply adds, as I said, this 216B, Section 2 of 3698, simply fits in solar projects within this old law that carved out 5% of SIP expenditures for certain renewable generation and clarifies how solar is to be treated under that regime, which is not as sensible now that we have a savings requirement. Okay. Section 3 defines what a solar project has to be like, set standards for solar thermal, solar electric. As you can see, solar thermal, which my understanding is are the more likely projects, have to meet a standard that's in statute and has to be, does not include equipment used to heat water or residential property for domestic use if less than 1/2 of the energy used for that purposes derived from the sun or for use in a hot tub or swimming pool. And so that's what this bill does. It clarifies how the solar generation projects will fit within the new savings regime of the savings SIP we enacted last year. Section 4, I believe, was a Department of Commerce initiative. I think it was. Anyway, there's only two solar laboratories in North America that can certify solar projects meeting standards. One is in Canada and one is somewhere else. And this is a little push in the direction of seeing if we can study and find out if we can have one here and get some of the economic benefits from the new solar regime. Bob?
Yeah, actually that came from a bill from Representative Saylor in the House. Okay. And right, there's only one place in America, in Florida, I believe, that does this now, and the thought is that a second place might be a good idea in terms of reducing costs for companies sending their equipment all the way down there, and especially companies around here in the Midwest.
Section 13 in the schematic we covered. Section 14, 3380. It's a bill that requires an additional level of notice. I'm confused. The Senate file I have, it provides when you're going to put in a transmission line or pipeline, a notice of intent be given to local units of government 180 days prior to filing the actual request for a certificate of need, and mandates a certain amount of hearings or meetings with local government units. And I only have one section on my copy, and I see there's three here, so I don't think we heard it, so I think this is the bill.
Yeah, this bill was not heard in the Senate at all.
So, Bob, why don't you tell us about 3717 in the House?
This was a bill that was introduced by Representative Kalin, and as John says, it pertains to giving local units of government advance notice of projects for which a route permit is going to be sought from the Public Utilities Commission, and allows I think it requires 120 days advance notice of the filing of that application with the commission, and during that time, the local units of government can arrange to have a meeting with the applicants, either one meeting or meeting separately, so the applicant can discuss the proposed route with those local units. That's pretty much it.
So, Bob, the House amended it after it was introduced then?
Yes, the House did amend it after it was introduced.
Bob, you want to do number 17? We don't have a...
Yeah, 17 is a provision in the House language that would allow owners of wind systems with a combined, that consist of single ownership with a nameplate capacity between 5 and 25 megawatts to elect either to be classified as a small wind energy conversion system or a large wind energy conversion system for purposes of site permits. Right now, that size differential determines whether you'd get a permit from the county or the Public Utilities Commission. This bill would, or this language would give projects between 5 and 25 megawatts the ability to choose which entity they wanted to receive a site permit from. Different rules apply to some degree.
I should note that my understanding is of the side-by-side, when you get the side-by-side, the ground rules for putting something in the side-by-side on either side is that a bill or that proposal passed the floor of either body. So if it's a Senate provision, it has to pass the Senate in some bill, and it's the House. So I raise that because I don't think there'll be a House or a Senate language here or on the high potential greenhouse gases as well, which is coming up soon. So it doesn't mean it can't be negotiated. It just won't be reflected in the side-by-side. The next bill is the vehicle, 3337. No, it's not. It's Senator Kubley's bill. And that last year in the environmental finance bill, some money was appropriated to the Center for Rural Policy and Development at Minnesota State University Mankato to provide a grant to an entity, select an entity to provide services for small wind developments, essentially, various sorts of assistance. And this bill, as you see, which is Senate File 2749, imposes an additional duty and provides, or may provide some money for that additionally to the same entity that was selected. And this is basically trying to avail small wind developers of the power of volume purchasing through aggregation. So it's trying to give economies of scale to smaller projects through activities of this entity that's selected. And I don't know if Senator Anderson, if there is money that...
I was just trying to remember, Madam Chair, Mr. Cole. I think we did... I think what we did with this is put it in Senator Divil's bill, I'm thinking. Someone from Commerce probably, maybe they don't know.
No, okay. It's not in there.
I don't remember, and we'll check on that. I think we did put some money either in the finance bill or in Senator Divil's bill. Well, but the money comes from the same. I'll have to check. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I think we have funded this.
Okay. It's carried in.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm not familiar with whether or not additional funding is required for this duty, or they can do within their current activities or not. The next bill is the base for the House omnibus bill. Which one are you looking at? Yeah, I was looking.
Excuse me, John.
I'm sorry, Bob.
Just going back to that last bill, in the House language, it's funded under an existing assessment under, is this the Reliability Administrator, 216C.052?
And that, Madam Chair, that is in the finance
Senator
bill.
Senator Anderson. Okay.
It is.
Okay. So we may have ours funded from a different source. We'll have to check on where it is in the Senate.
Okay. Okay.
Is that it, Bob, or is it something else? Okay. On 19 on the schematic, Senate File 3337 in the Senate is a bill that provides a process for understanding, having report backs from the administration on the progress towards meeting the greenhouse gas emission reduction goals that were established last year. An annual report back on proposals to meet it, and every 2 year report on how we're doing. And it also provides a set of principles. So the Department of Commerce and the PCA are going to come in every other year and say, here's where we're at. And every year, they're going to come in and tell us what tools they think we can use to get there, or they can tell us they don't think there is any tools. But at least they have to make an appearance and a presentation. And the legislation should be based on a set of principles, which is articulated in the bill, such as reductions must be attained. The reductions must be attained on a schedule that keeps pace with the reductions required. Conservation should be the first choice, and so on. Bob?
In the House, we've got similar provisions, except those reduction principles that you just mentioned are not in the House language.
And then the from 21 to 24, the high potential greenhouse gases and the mobile refrigerant provisions. The Senate did not hear it, and my understanding is the House has heard it and amended it, so it would probably most benefit, and the advocates are supportive of that, so it would make sense for the House to explain where it's at now, because that's where it is.
Sure. Starting with Section 20 on page R15, there's a number of definitions here, including, most importantly, probably high GWP greenhouse gases, GWP meaning global warming potential. This is a number of gases that have a global warming potential much greater than that of carbon dioxide. And the ones that are defined in this bill include hydrofluorocarbons, perfluorocarbons, and sulfur hexafluoride. And there are a number of provisions pertaining to those gases, the first of which is a reporting system on Section 21 on page R16. This requires manufacturers of those gases who sell to a person in Minnesota purchasing 100 metric tons or more carbon dioxide equivalent each year to report to the agency. Part of the problem here is we don't know how much of these gases are in Minnesota or who is using them for what purposes. And Section 21 is an attempt to start finding out the answers to those questions. So it would require manufacturers, both in-state and out-of-state, to report purchases of that size. Section 22 is a provision that requires a disclosure of any manufacturer selling a new motor vehicle in Minnesota of the rate of leakage from the air conditioning system. This has been identified as another source of high global warming potential gases being emitted to the atmosphere, the chief one being something called HFC-134A, which I believe has 150 times the global warming potential of carbon dioxide. So this provision would require manufacturers selling cars in Minnesota to disclose what the leakage rate of those air conditioners are based on a methodology essentially provided in a publication by the Society of Automotive Engineers. And that information is to be posted on the website, both of the Attorney General's office. Only the Attorney General's office. Okay. At one point, we had the PCA in there as well, along with a statement indicating that the air conditioning system can leak, and that the chart would compare the leakage rates of various makes and models. Section 23 of the bill on page R17 specifies that. The preceding provisions can be enforced under Section 116.072, which is the administrative penalty authority of the PCA. Section 24 requires a report from the commissioner to the legislature identifying the uses and emission sources of these high GWP gases and also suggesting options for reducing or eliminating those uses and emissions and, importantly, the cost of implementing those options for reduction. And those options for reduction are also to include phasing out specific consumer products which contain these gases in cases where that is cost effective. And that brings that those House provisions up to date.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hilty.
Just one thing about that, Mr. Eloff. The PCA still is included in the posting on line 18 on page 15.
Ah, says correct.
The first is
the agency. Yeah.
Means the Pollution Control Agency.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, we did 25 under the Senator Dahl bill already, and 26 was under the Petro Fund, the repealer. And then the next one is strategic tree planting, 3089 Senate file. That's an amendment to the SIP law. It's trying to give a boost to get trees planted.
It's not being included.
Oh, okay. What's in there? All right. The trees have met the shade.
Great. So.
So the next one is broadband mapping. And as you can see, that's the chairs in the Senate passed. We had the Department of Commerce, basically the Department of Commerce worked with the committee and came up with a proposal they thought they could do within their budget constraints. And it has two prongs. One is an inventory. The question would be the question is whether the inventory is sufficient or not, and then a mapping provision which would reflect the data in the inventory. And the purpose of this, it responds to the concern that, maybe Bob and Representative Johnson might want to talk about it. But that's the language in the Senate side.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The mapping project directs that the Commissioner of Commerce contract a nonprofit organization, and Connected Nation is the organization we had in mind. And the idea of it is to get the kind of information down to the level of detail that'll make a map useful, that we'll get enough accurate information down to the kind of granular level that will provide the kind of information in terms of actual speeds rather than reported speeds, in terms of defining where cell towers are for wireless information, and in terms of providing information both to providers, to consumers, and to the task force, which was recently a bill passed by House Senate and signed by the governor, set up to move the whole issue of broadband forward in terms of establishing a goal and a comprehensive plan to get to that goal. So that's the essence of the mapping project.
Okay, and then Representative Johnson, we also did not hear the cable franchising study in the Senate, so would either you or Mr. Eloff like to address that?
The issue of the bill having to do with doing the study come from some work we've done on the House side looking at the issue of statewide franchising of cable TV. Currently, it's all cable TV is municipally franchised. I introduced a bill last year for the sake of discussion, largely so you can find some level of compromise or areas of agreement on the whole issue of franchising. What came up was a lot of disagreement on what the actual facts are on how well statewide franchising has worked in other states and what the implication ramifications were for PEG and franchise fees and how you treat local franchises currently and so forth. So what this particular study would direct is that three states be looked at that have passed statewide franchising to get some accurate information that could be brought back to the House and Senate to make more seasoned and reasoned judgments on how to best proceed with the whole issue of franchising.
Okay, thank you. And then, Mr. Fuller, the next two provisions are in the Senate. Our Senate bills that pass the Senate, but there is no House bill companion.
Madam Chair, the 3341, which is the second one down, the second block down, has two purposes. One is hopefully maybe access some federal funds for compiling a greenhouse gas inventory, and the other is a notion that to give consumers ideas of how green their businesses are. And what it does is it's a voluntary program on the business side to disclose some energy uses to a municipality, which is then required to provide public access to that information. And there is no house companion?
No, there is. It's on the house floor.
Okay, and then 3520 is a bill with three provisions. One directs the current Electric Energy Task Force to look at the economic, environment, and social implications of state energy plans and policies. So it amends the general law with respect to legislative Electric Energy Task Force, and it repeals in Section 3 the specific directive to only look at the Manitoba Hydro social consequences. And then last year there was a law passed that provided for the termination of property rights related to wind energy development after 5 years if they weren't commercially operational. This repeals that, but for a number of reasons, but it gives a one-year delayed effective date so that if there's a better solution than repealing it, that can be enacted in the next session. Well, the next one, Madam Chair, the outdoor light one, when I looked at it, the Senate bill passed in the law last year. There is a Senate bill that passed in the law, and it has to do with a model ordinance for local units of government about, I guess, light pollution or that, and also some requirements for state funding of outdoor lighting. And that passed in the law, and the House bill has a lot of similar provisions but differences, so I'm not sure why the House bill is moving along now. There must be a reason.
My recollection of the reason is that only part of the House, this was a bill that was introduced by Representative Kahn, and only part of it got enacted last year, and this is the rest of it.
What would the rest of it be?
Well, the rest of it is it basically establishes what conditions under which an outdoor lighting fixture can be installed or replaced, and probably most important thing are the exceptions in here, which a number of people were concerned about.
Okay, so that basically is a walkthrough of the provisions that are before the conference committee. And I think since we have a little bit of time here, I'm going to ask for testimony from the public if there are some provisions that you want to testify on. But before we do that, are there any questions or comments by the committee members? The other thing that I would like to do is the House has a commitment at 3 o'clock, so we will be adjourning at 3 o'clock. And what I'd like to do is to recess for a while the side-by-side is put together, and then we can come back together briefly, walk through the side-by-side and adopt perhaps the same and similar and find out where we have differences and then discuss how we'll proceed from that point on. But I don't expect we'll be meeting very late tonight. So is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify on provisions that are before the conference committee? Please come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the conference committee, my name is Charles Dayton. I'm a retired attorney, and I do some volunteering on energy and global warming issues. I was a member of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, the report of which is about to be issued in final with the comments of the public attached. And I want to speak to the provision on high potential global warming gases, which starts on page 14 of the House File 3337. which was heard in the House but not heard in the Senate. I was on the technical working group that recommended this provision to the full MCAG, and I was on the subcommittee of that working group that recommended a provision like this to the technical working group. There were two members of the subcommittee, me and Jeff Moffitt, who was the environmental representative from the 3M company. And we worked out a recommendation that was accepted by the technical working group and then unanimously by the entire Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, which, as you know, has a broad representation from all of the major industries and all of the major segments of Minnesota society. The MCAG recommendation was more aggressive than the bill that's before you. The MCAG recommendation said that we should have the PCA do a rulemaking process and ban these substances where that can be done at zero or negative cost. And there are a number of substances where there are cheaper alternatives available. And we're talking about substances which have multiples of 10,000 or 20,000 times the impact of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere because they absorb more of the solar radiation that's being reflected back into space. The MCAG report found that that could be done at a negative cost of $5 per ton. So that's why we're suggesting that this is a place to start. The MCAG recommendations calculated that in the year 2030, when the bill that you passed last year said we want to achieve a 30% reduction, that we could do that, and that would be 50 million tons of emissions in that year, in the year 2025, 30% in the year 2025. So this is a start on that. But in order to do that, we would have to do all of the MCAG recommendations. Some of the comments that are coming in now from the public question the calculations, question whether we can really get to that goal with the proposals. And this is the beginning of that process. But we know that these are gases that have a high impact. In many cases, they can be substituted for, they have substitutes which are less expensive. And it just makes sense to start with the low-hanging fruit. So I'd be happy to answer any questions on the bill.
Now, again, this was a bill that was not heard in the Senate. It was introduced by Senator Rast, but I believe there was not time to hear it in the Environment Committee. So, are there any questions or comments of Mr. Dayton? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dayton, thank you. I'd heard earlier that it was about using this as a kind of a map, I guess, of who's using it and for what purposes. Right now, we don't know who's using these gases at all. We don't have really a clue. Is that the initial idea, is to try to figure out who's using them first and then make recommendations from there?
Mr. Dayton.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, we have an understanding of the kinds of uses that are being made for many of these gases. We know that they're used in mobile air conditioning in cars, for example, and also refrigerated trucks. We know that they're used for refrigerants in grocery stores, aerosols. They're used as an electric insulator. They're used for fire extinguishers. They're used in the manufacture of semiconductors, and there are certain solvents. But we don't know exactly who's using them and how much is being used. So the first step is to require a reporting where over 100 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent is being purchased in the state so that we can get an idea of where those industries are. I view this, frankly, as the first step toward a rulemaking in this area, but we need the information first.
Senator Rosen, Senator Dahl, do you have further questions?
Yes, if I could, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Dayton. Was there a fiscal note that went with this as far as how much it would cost the agency to do the study?
Maybe. I don't know if Mr. Dayton knows or if Mr. Eloff can answer that. Mr. Dayton, are you aware?
Madam Chair, I do know that there was a fiscal note, Senator Dahl, and there is no cost to the general fund associated with this. The cost of doing the study would be absorbed by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and they have that in their budget for next year.
Okay. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Dayton, it's interesting. In the language, it says a person in the state who purchases 100 metric tons or more. And you gave a few examples of who would be or what that would be used for, but what kind of business? Is this more of a business or a person? Or tell me how, the size of 100 metric tons. I guess I'm a little confused about this quantity. And are we aiming it towards a medium size amount or a company that uses a medium amount of this carbon dioxide? Or
Mr. Dayton.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, the total number of reportees is estimated by the agency as about 1,000. And they would include, it's a chiller for grocery stores, so if you have a large grocery store, that would probably be included. People who service air conditioning units on cars that might be purchasing that much of it for their services. People who make fire extinguishers. And that's one of the reasons we want to do the inventory, is to find out who's using it and how much is being used.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dayton, to this day, there is no regulation, or not, I shouldn't say regulations, but any further reporting that these companies or persons have to do to buy, to use the carbon dioxide. Is there any other further reporting?
Mr. Dayton.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, so far as I know, there is no requirement that these are three of the six gases that are included in the Kyoto Treaty. The United States is required to report to the United Nations Agency every year as to how much of these gases are being used in the United States or how much are being emitted. But in terms of the specifics, there is no requirement that individual companies report anywhere as to their use of these gases that I'm aware of.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Okay, thank you, Mr. Dayton.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anybody else who would like to testify at this time? Must be a mild bill. Huh? Come forward, Ms. Daniels.
Thank you for the opportunity. I just want to make a few comments, Madam Chair and the rest of the committee. My name is Lisa Daniels. I'm the Executive Director of Windustry. Windustry is a nonprofit based in Minneapolis, and we work on community wind energy. And we also work on wind on an increasing opportunities for economic development from wind energy. I was also a member over the last period of time. I was a member of the LEETF working group to study seabed, aspects of seabed. And I was on the subcommittee that was working on this, on the issue for which I want to make a comment about, which is the Senate File 3520, the repeal of the wind easement law. So I just wanted to say a few things that the repeal of the law does not provide any mechanism for stakeholders to meet and work it out, or to work out any other solutions. And that is of concern. I would say that the existing law is in place, and it does protect landowners. And I would say it's it's protecting landowners right now as we sit here, because as wind energy is taking off in the state, it's important that landowners and actually wind developers themselves have some protections that somebody cannot just walk in and tie up the land for an indefinite amount of time. And this provision, as it stands in law right now, protects and it is probably the first step towards a best practices kind of a provision to protect landowners and to protect good developers from maybe ill-resourced developers or indifferent wind developers or maybe incompetent wind developers, so that the land is not tied up indefinitely and no wind projects get onto that land. So it is a best practice for to protect other industry members as well as wind industry members as well as landowners, so that wind projects can get into place. And there is, so just for example, if there is a good wind developer with a good project that they are trying to get in the ground, but they can't get around a project, they can't get a project in the ground because a developer has leased a large quantity of land or some key pieces of land, and they have that land indefinitely, then this will hamper all wind development in the state. So I just wanted to bring that up as a piece, and I realized that within this working committee on seabed, like many of the other issues on that seabed working committee, there were no definite solutions that everyone could agree on. But I just wanted to bring those points up about this repeal. That it is in place and it is protecting landowners and good wind developers right now.
Thank you, Ms. Daniels. I would like to remind the committee, however, that this was language that was adopted during our conference committee last year. We had some angst about it in that it was not vetted by our judiciary committees. And so we didn't have a lot of good testimony on what was needed in order for the contract to be workable. We did then establish a working group, and Ms. Daniels was on that working group. And the intention of adopting the language last year was that the working group would come back with language that we could accept. That working group has not come up with language. And so the purpose of this repealer at this time, which is about 15 months or 14 months out, June of 2009 is when the repealer would go into effect, is to kind of hold people's feet to the ground and to make them come together and sit down and work things out. We do have some commitment from Mr. Bull that he would be willing to hold those stakeholder meetings and to negotiate that. And we also have agreed that we would be willing to continue to work with the stakeholders to come to some agreement on what would be a good contract term. Because we have also heard from some parties that 7 years prohibits the ability or inhibits the ability to get wind energy out there because of it interfering with financing arrangements in some cases. So there are pros and cons for all of it, and I just wanted to give you some background for why this language was adopted by the Senate at the time that it was. But I know that we continue to have disagreements about that. And we've been looking at some compromise language that might be helpful too. So. Are there any further questions or comments?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Daniels. This is just an information question. When you go to have a wind project or put up a tower, how many acres does it take? Is it less than an acre? Do you lease 1 acre? How big is the plot of land for a tower?
Well, the
Ms.
footprint,
Daniels.
It's... Thank you, Madam Chair. The footprint itself for the wind turbine is quite small. It's either 20 feet by 20 feet or 40 feet by 40 feet. It's, you know, it's very succinct. But you do have to preserve the wind and the footprint or the buffer zone of the wind. And so that's where it does take more land. So that's where it does take more land. And it really does depend on the size of the wind turbine itself and the rotor diameter of the blades to know how much land is needed for that buffer zone. Usually there is a rule of thumb that we're using in the state that it's a 3x5 rotor diameters, and it's the 5 rotor diameter spacing is in the most is where the wind is most prevailing, and the 3 rotor diameter spacing is in the lesser directions.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair. Ms. Daniels, how large a piece of track of land would you need for a 5 rotor tower for blades?
Ms. Daniels.
It could be more than an acre, depending on the size of the wind turbine. Itself.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator
Ms. Daniels, so we're basically talking approximately an acre per tower is what is required. And, of course, I would assume you mentioned the buffers. There would have to be some spacing between that, but not a tremendous amount of land is needed per unit.
Exactly.
Ms. Daniels. Further questions? Comments, Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, thank you. I don't know if we can follow up with this, but you had mentioned, and maybe Ms. Daniels can address it too, about that 7-year time period being an obstacle for financing. And I guess I'm not recollecting the previous testimony we had before last year, but maybe if you could comment on that. I'd like to know why that would be an impediment to the financing.
Yeah. I'm going to let Mr. Fuller explain some of that.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, our law said it had to be commercially operational within 7 years or you terminate your property right. So when a lender looks at the stability of the project, if there's a risk that because of the queue and or any other time factor, particularly the smaller projects, then they would be less inclined to lend at a rate that was more expensive because it could happen that the project spends a lot of money and then the underlying property interest is terminated and they're at risk then to renegotiate or lose their interest. So that's the financing risk because you have destabilized that property interest.
Thank you. Answers it.
Further questions? Thank you, Ms. Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
Any further testimony at this time?
Madam Chair?
Senator Dahl.
I'm sorry to take up all of the microphone
okay.
time
you
here,
take
but
up as much
I'd
time
heard
as you.
That, and since we have a couple minutes, that there was a question about, I don't know if which bill it is, but about maybe it might be the 120-day rule, and I was hoping I could hear some testimony on that. This, and it was one of the bills I don't think we heard. It was on...
And the Kalen bill. And
it's
the
large
certificate of need.
Energy facility certificate of need. That might be it.
Yes. Actually, I told. Oh, it's not yet.
This is
you have to give 120 days. Is there anybody here that could answer that question? We'll get somebody to come and address that. Okay. Any further questions or comments? Well, then we will recess till probably around
4:30 or 5, so 5.
Okay, around 5 o'clock. Okay. You can leave your stuff here today, although in the future we're going to be meeting in 112, I think. After today. Today we'll meet here. Okay, we'll call back to order the conference committee on Senate File 3337. And we do have the side-by-side language now, so we will walk through that and we will be prepared to adopt the same and similar language as possible. Are you going to lock us this? Well, you're going to point out for us the same language that we can begin to adopt. Okay.
Good evening. This is on the side-by-side. We start on page 1, and the House language is on the left. First section has to do with oil petroleum spill language. And the first section is very close, and it's very similar, but we just don't know why there's a difference in the language with respect to the Attorney General. We think it's not substantial, but we'd like to check with the authors and make sure there's not some non-intuitive reason they did it. So that is very same, but it's not proposed to be adopted. On R1, Section 2, it's proposed that the House language be adopted. It's identical. And it has to do with obsolete language. It's a program for reimbursement, and the time has passed. Do you want to move those then, or do you want to move them at the end? Or?
Ben, Chair, if you want to do that as we go, I would move it at adoption.
Representative Hilty moves adoption of Section 2 on page 1.
The House side.
Of the House side. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Section 3, again, is the program for the replacing the PVC piping. It's similar. And I believe that no matter what, if we do take the House language, you might want to make a note. Now, my understanding is on 2.32, everything after residence to the end of that sentence would be deleted, although the whole section isn't being offered now. But it might be good to make a note of that now. If Chair Hilty, I think, agreed to that.
Should we wait to adopt that?
Well, you might want to just make a note, so if we do adopt it, it's gone. You don't need a motion, just tell people to draw a line through it.
Why would you remove that?
Madam Chair, the reason for deleting that language is that's in a statement of purpose, but it also seems to set a legal standard that there has to be some unknowing violation of, or not knowing that the glue is not going to hold the pipe together, and, you know, okay. Just an excess of caution, I guess. If you don't need the language necessarily, why create a potential problem?
Okay. Section 4, then.
Section 4 is no Senate position. Section 5 is similar. This would be from, I can't remember, I should pull it. This is the package that's the cost recovery for transmission. Senator Dahl's bill, I don't remember who.
It's the same.
Brainerd in the House. That Section 5 is similar. My understanding is that 5, 6, and 7 are similar. Representative Briner, I understand, is in discussions with somebody about a change to one of these sections, and so I don't know which one it is. And so I don't know if you want to 5, 6, and 7, 6, 7, and 8 are identical, but there may be something coming in later which we could add. We could adopt it now with the understanding that there might be some non-controversial change.
Representative Chair, I believe we could adopt the language that's the same. The only difference is that in Section 6, the obligations versus objectives and standards. Okay. That's it. Right.
And we're offering this the House language.
Okay, yes. Yeah. Then I think we could adopt it if Senator Dahl agrees, and we could look at those. Recommendations are coming from the department and Excel for some very small modification. They see some cost implications to the language that weren't initially observed, so they have a proposed amendment that they'll offer later.
And Representative Briner, is that in a specific section? Is that in Section 5?
I believe it's Section 5. Senator Dahl, is that your understanding?
Yes.
Yes,
that's the section.
Yes.
Madam Chair, that is correct. That is Section 5. And I, if I could, I missed part of what we were looking at doing with that section as well to line that up.
Well, my question is, could we adopt the House language on Sections 6, 7, and 8?
For sure. Madam Chair, I guess my understanding was that on obligations, there was a reason why we wanted obligations is because that's now that objectives and standards are kind of what in place, so what we now have is obligations. That's why they chose that language originally, why we were looking at that. So could we go over that one more time? Why we it's okay to drop obligations?
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dahl, my understanding of that is the original language that we both passed substituted obligations for objectives, and in the House on the floor we amended that to leave objectives and include standards. Standards was not in the original language, and Excel agreed that that covered their intent.
Okay.
So if you'd like them to testify to that, but that was my understanding of the discussion.
Madam Chair and Representative Briner, if that's okay with Excel, and I would agree with that.
Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say, when the amendment was proposed in the House, we did check with Excel before accepting the amendment.
Well, why don't we have somebody from Excel come forward and provide some background?
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say that I think objectives and standards, because it refers to what's in statute, is more specific, and I think so I kind of like that House definition. I mean, it's still an objective till 2010, and maybe that's so we should refer to both of them, and obligations is kind of sort of a vaguer term. So it just.
Mr. Bull, have you a new job?
Madam Chair, I'm Mike Bull with the Office of Energy Security. On this specific issue, the one thing I wanted to talk about is the Section 5 language on transmission cost adjustment that I talked to Representative Briner and Senator Dahl about, but I don't want to move off of this issue until.
So you're here to talk about the changes that the department wants to make in the first section?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, go ahead.
I just wanted to reiterate, I got pulled into another meeting. I had language for John, but what we had talked about with Excel, our technical rate staff looked at some of the language and thought maybe that if we just had additional clarifying language, they would feel more comfortable when they analyze these rider petitions for the commission. And it's a language that specifies that things that revenues and costs need to be netted out before approval and go into the ratepayers to pay for those.
When can you have that language available?
I have it with me, but so I can bring it whenever it's it works.
Okay, you can offer it to us.
Oh, you mean like now?
Get her done.
Madam Chair, well, we're waiting.
Senator Anderson.
I'm trying to see what the difference, you said in Section 5 it's similar, but I'm trying to see what the differences are. I can't find the difference.
It's the same.
Same.
It is the same, Section 5, okay.
It is the same, but there are some recommendations to make some changes
sure.
to it.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hilty, can we just wait to hear from Excel about the obligations versus the standards and objectives? Okay. Mr. Ball.
Madam Chair, the language we're looking for would be R3. It's line 411 on the House side.
Mm-hmm.
Put a period after tariff and include this sentence. Such charges must be reduced or offset by revenues received by the utility.
Slow down.
Right, yeah.
Hand this to John after I'm done. Revenues received by the utility and by charges the utility is allowed. To charge to other regional transmission owners. Comma.
Comma.
How long is this?
To the extent those revenues and charges have not been otherwise offset. That's
okay, once more.
Yes, ma'am. Such charges must be reduced or offset by revenues received by the utility, by charges the utility is allowed to charge to other regional transmission owners, comma, to the extent those revenues and charges have not been otherwise offset.
You can give it to me, too.
Yep, and I'll give this to John as well.
Repeat after regional again.
To other regional transmission owners, comma, to the extent those revenues and charges have not been otherwise offset. And I apologize for bringing this to you in this form.
Read after the comma.
Yes, ma'am. To the extent those revenues and charges have not been otherwise offset.
I'll read it back to you.
Okay. Mr. Fuller's going to read it back to you.
We're going to put a period after tariff on line 411 on the House side, and we say such charges must be reduced or offset by revenues received by the utility and by charges the utility is allowed to charge to other regional transmission owners, comma, to the extent those revenues and charges have not been otherwise offset, semicolon.
Is there discussion about that language? Would one of you like to offer that? Representative
Fuller just said.
Okay, Representative Hilty moves the language that has been recommended. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Evans, were you going to come forward?
Madam Chair, Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. On the discussion of whether it says objectives and standards or obligations, it was our intention that we would include the objectives and the standards. So if that's the preferable language, that's fine with us. I think either one covers it. But the idea was this is essentially the section that gives us cost recovery for building the wind that was required by the objectives. And when we adopted the standards last year, we forgot to include those. I think we would have done that last year if we'd thought of it, to include those in that section. So This is just trying to bring all of those things together into the one cost recovery provision.
Okay, any discussion or any further questions about that? Do you want to move that aside? For 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yes. Madam Chair, I would move the House language. Section 5 as amended, Section 6, 7, 8.
Okay, on Representative Hilty's motion, any discussion? And all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion adopted.
Madam Chair, on R6, Section 9, 7.3, is what's known as a solar carve-out from the, that's on the House side. As part of the Renewable Energy Standard, there's no Senate position. As we said earlier, there was a Senate bill that did not pass out of committee.
Is this right?
Madam Chair, this is the obligation for a utility subject to the Renewable Energy Standard to meet that standard by, if you look at on page R7, by at the end of 2012, at least 0.0125% by a solar generation is a rough description of it.
Well, let's put this aside for now because we haven't.
Oh, yeah. It's
okay.
This is not a same or similar.
Okay.
So on R8, this is part of the package that has to do with solar projects and SIP and the old law that said you could do 5% of your spending on solar generation, and now we have a SIP law that says no matter what you spend, you should have certain savings, so we have two tests, and this is the first one, and Section 10 is not same or similar. No. There's slight differences. As you'll notice on 8.22 and 2.16, the spirit's the same, the wording is different.
Okay.
Section 11, definitions. Again, that's part of, this is now we're in the section that has to do with the generation by renewables that can, SIP money can be used for under an old law. Again, we're similar, but we're not identical. And there are differences. Section 12 on page R9, and I'm going down the House side. This, again, is in the statute that allows certain generation expenditures to be made with SIP money for renewables, and it defines what clarifies what solar energy projects that money can be used for. And that's not identical. Section 13 is the same. And that is the certificate of need law and an exemption if a facility is a wind or a solar facility to be used to meet or exceed the RES. There is commission involvement, though, to obtain the exemption. It's not an absolute grant. And that's the same. Same effective date, and it would be the same would be the House, Section 13 on R10.
Okay. Do you
want to?
Well, Madam Chair,
okay, on Representative Hilty's motion, any discussion? Representative Westrom.
Speaker, or Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, maybe can you just refresh my memory what we're, or maybe staff could just refresh my memory what we're eliminating here in the certificate of need?
Sure. This provision would make it essentially exempt the need for a certificate of need from wind energy or solar facilities that are used to meet or exceed the obligations of the RES. And as Mr. Fuller pointed out, the commission does need to make a determination under this provision.
The language is identical in both the House and the Senate on this provision. Any further questions? Okay, then on Representative Hilty's motion that we adopt Section 13, the House provision, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, let's go back to R8 because I misspoke. We decided there are some identical ones, but we decided to take the Senate language very similar, which is Section R8 at the top of the page on the right. That. We decided we'd go with the Senate. There's different language, but they're exactly the same intent, you see.
So the language is similar, and you're recommending the Senate
language? The substance is the same. Yeah, the substance is the same.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I see. I think you're talking about this on R8, line 2.16.
Right.
Yes.
It refers to projects in Minnesota, mm-hmm. which this House, I don't see Minnesota.
Okay.
And I think that's a good idea
okay.
to have it be Minnesota projects qualifying. So I would that's a small difference, but I think the Senate language is preferable.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, I would concur with that. It actually parallels the
So you're recommending adoption of the Senate language?
Section 2.
Madam Chair, I would move adoption of the Senate language on page R8, section 2.
Okay. Any discussion? On Representative Hilty's motion, then, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, on the stay on page R8, the Senate Section 3. It must be that again. The language is a little different, the substance is the same. It goes all the way to R9. And you can see they match up. Madam Chair, the only difference is in that, I think, is in the phraseology on R8 2.29, which again is just a stylistic difference. There's no substance.
Representative Saylor, do you have any comments on that?
Madam Chair, no. As long as it meets the same substance, it's fine.
Okay. Discussion on Representative Hilty's motion. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Fuller.
We're on R10 on the House side. You'll see there's no Senate position on R10 or R11. Section 14, 15, and 16, I believe, has to do with this prior notification to local units of government of pipeline and high voltage transmission line routes, but I see there's been some changes made since the original bill. The Senate has no position on this. So Section 14 requires the notice to be given 120 days before an actual filing, and to local units of government where the route will impact. Section 15 requires, you can see, a meeting with these local units of government. And Section 14 looks like it's fairly technical, that changes that accompany this, changing some township to town and shall to are, shall be to are, and shall to does. So that looks like it's technical, but it's grouped with those first two, 14 and 15.
Okay, we'll hold on that.
Section 17 gives an option to owners of, there's no Senate position, is on R11.
We'll hold on that.
We'll hold on that one, okay. You'll notice on 12.4, this is a temporary provision.
In the House, at some point, you may wish to address that.
Sure. When we start addressing the language where there is no companion or there are differences, then we'll have an opportunity to address that. Section 18, there's no Senate language either, so.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
I should just mention, I still haven't tracked down where this bill ended up, but we did pass it out of my division, and so it was supported in the Senate. I'm not quite sure where it got lost along the way, but there was support for this in committee. It was heard in committee and passed.
Yes.
Or OC.
No, this was Kubla.
That was Kubla. Yeah, well, it says it's in finance.
Well, Madam Chair, I think all I've been able to determine so far is we did pass it out of my division to the Finance Committee as a standalone bill, but I thought that I had rolled it into my finance bill as well, but I haven't had a chance to confirm that. I know it's on, pretty sure it's in the finance bill on the House side, correct? Because there isn't a, I'm not sure. Anyway, I haven't gotten a final answer on that. But the bill, the standalone bill is still in the Finance Committee. Senator Kubley's bill.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look further at that, and we can address it later. Right now, we'll just focus on what is the same. Mr. Fuller.
R13. Section 19 on the House side at the top of the page, and Section 1, that's Senate File 3337. It's the proposal in there. As you can tell just by looking at it, there's less language in the House side than there's in the Senate. We have some principles. It has a twofold purpose. One is to have a report back from the executive branch as to the progress made in meeting greenhouse gas emission goals, and the second primary aim of this legislation is to keep the proposals coming forth to the legislature that would help meet those goals on an annual basis. I see that in the House on 13.12 we have even numbered years, and in the Senate it was put in odd with the thought that would be the beginning of the two-year session, and it seemed like then we'd there'd be more opportunity to chew on whatever came forward for a while. Okay.
We'll hold on that.
On R16, the solar rating and certification laboratory, 16.7 on the House side, Section 25, 3.22 on the Senate, those are identical. And the proposed that, for no good reason, that the Senate language be accepted.
date difference.
Yes, we want the House language. What? Oh, that's right. And Madam Chair?
Yes.
This has been, there is an executive order that creates the Office of Energy Security. And this is not a political issue. It's just that when we have these reorganization orders and you have an entity that doesn't exist anywhere in the statutes and that order expires at the end of the governor's term, we've had experience where they've brought in legislation to codify those changes and it doesn't happen and it leads to a lot of conclusions. So in some other bills, not all, but in some others, I know in Senator Rosen's, we changed it to the Commissioner of Commerce because that's in the statutes. And if you put the Office of Energy Security in here, one, it may go away, and two is nobody will know it. I mean, it doesn't exist in the statute. So it's just throwing that out there for you. My personal opinion is a good idea to change it to something that's in the statute because we don't know what's going to happen to the Office of Energy Security. Although this is not a permanent statute. But anyway, that's... But I think we do have to go with the immediate effective date because they're engaged in some activities for which they have to report back. So we might as well get them going as soon as they can.
That's fine. If we have more discussions.
I don't see Director Garvey.
Yeah, he's
right there. Oh, would you like to comment on this?
How did I put that on the wrong side? Because we might have been
able to amend
it. Mr. Garvey.
Well, there are a lot of people who would like me to go away, Madam Chair, but I think. I mean, for all intents and purposes, we're here, we exist in executive order. Your legal counsel, Mr. Fuller, has sort of pointed out sort of a, we'll call it an anomaly in the arrangement. I mean, yes, he's right, it's done by an executive order. At the same time, it is sort of a designation that's more specific than the commissioner of the Department of Commerce.
But the Commissioner of Commerce can always delegate, right? I think what Mr. Fuller is saying is that it's not in statute. So,
it's always dangerous to argue with Mr. Fuller since he's generally right, Madam Chair.
Okay.
The Office of Energy Security is not in statute. The Department of Commerce is. For all intents and purposes, the Commissioner has delegated all responsibility under the executive order affirms that to the position of Director of the Office of Energy Security, and the Office of Energy Security has been created within the executive order. That's all I probably should say on this matter.
Yeah, unfortunately. Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, you point out that this section deals with the report that 2009 still existed at that point.
Right. That's what I said. It's a short-term deal. It's not as big as the other.
Right.
Throw him a crown.
So, Madam Chair, with that, I would move adoption of the House language.
Is there discussion on that motion? All those in favor, then, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Mr. Fuller.
The repealer? They're similar. That has to do with the petroleum tank reimbursement fund, and this is part of the bill that was in the first few sections, but the repealer comes to the back. It repeals a section or a subdivision that's obsolete. And so it's consistent with one of the other sections in the bill. And I think we want the House because get rid of it right now.
Madam Chair, I would move adoption of section 26.
Okay. any discussion about the motion? Then on the motion, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Fuller.
Well, Madam Chair, if we're just doing same or similar, then we would go down to the R-19 broadband mapping project on the House side, Section 13, broadband inventory project on the Senate side, and those would be the that would be the language that would be negotiated over it. It's not the same. And that's it. I mean, that's it for same or similar. Did you want to just brush on the things that were there? You're right.
Well, we've just become aware that there are pieces that are missing from the side-by-side, so it won't affect what we have done so far, but we will have to come together at some point and go over some additional language. None of this stuff was added. What is it?
Where's yours?
It is unless the section is repealer.
Looks like that would be the real estate stuff. That should be here.
Like,
I don't see the
like
one. And I don't see. Yeah. How did that drop out? Oh, here it is. It's right here. It's right here. Yeah, I think we're okay. I'll go back and go over the ones that we just skipped. People want to know where stuff is. Oops. Madam Chair?
Mr. Fuller.
Just going, I think it is all there. Go back to R-17, and we'll just touch on things so people know where stuff is, even though they're not same or similar. That Section 3 on 192.22 comes out 1812. It's money for the various telecom projects, it looks like. See here. Yes. The video franchise study and the broadband mapping project. I don't know about the numbers, but that's what that is. Then the outdoor lighting is Section 5. I believe that was Representative Kahn's. And we had discussed that the part of the bill had been passed last year, but apparently not all of it. And then Section 13 on R-18 is what Representative Johnson had discussed, the state video franchising study, which is funded earlier there. And then we had talked about on R-19, the broadband project, mapping versus inventory. And then on R-20, the Senate side, Section 1 at 1.9, gives a charge to the Electric Energy Task Force to do economic, environmental, and social implications analysis of energy plans and policies. And Section 2 is the wind easement, repealer language, striking language at the bottom of R-20. And on R-21 is a repealer that's related to the economic, environmental, and social implications language. This made me nervous. Sorry.
Oh, me too.
How did I miss it? Because my eyes are terrible. But it turned all white to me.
Thank you.
Okay, that concludes our business before the committee at this time. We have a fairly full day tomorrow with session and other conference committees that are also meeting. And so we will leave this, the next meeting, to the call of the chair, but I think it will be on Thursday. Any questions? Meeting adjourned. Thank you.